All right, Erev Tov, welcome to part 13 of Great Rabbis of the 20th Century, sponsored again by Becky and Avi Katz, Le'ilu Nishmas, Yonah ben Rav Aryeh Leib. Tonight we're talking about Rav Yisrael Meir Cohen Kagan, the Chavetz Chaim. It's hard to imagine a Jew who was more beloved in his time and thereafter than the Chavetz Chaim. So the truth is, I didn't think originally to include him in this series, because most of his life, just chronologically, was lived in the 19th century, two-thirds of his life, roughly. Only one-third of his life was lived in the 20th century. But then I realized, first, it's my series, I make the rules, what's the difference? But second, more importantly, the influence of the Chafetz Chaim hovered over his generation and ours as well. So it's unquestionable that he is personally responsible for any Shmiras HaLashon campaign or interest that exists in the world today. He basically restored that mitzvah, which was a mace mitzvah, to the world of the living Torah. When people just assumed that it was understood, you know, it was winked at, not taken seriously, didn't really define the moral life of a Jew. It's an aspiration, but it's not a serious mitzvah. After all, the Gemara says in Baba Basra, Daf Kuf Samech Hei Amar Aleph, it ends there, Rov Begezel, most people are guilty of theft, Umiut Ba'aroyos, and a minority are guilty of sexual crimes or sins, V'hakol B'Lashon Hara. But everybody is guilty of Lashon Hara. So Gemara says, Lashon Hara Salka Daitach, everybody talks Lashon Hara. The Gemara answers, El Avak Lashon Hara, at least the dust of Lashon Hara. Meaning, Lashon Hara as a mitzvah, or as an Avera, suffers from the everybody does it syndrome. The Chafetz Chaim put it on the map, that everybody doesn't do it, and everybody shouldn't do it. So that would be enough, but he also authored the Mishnah Brura, as a commentary on Shulchan Aruch Arachayim, that's a staple of every Jewish home. It's a go-to reference, a sefer that has achieved near universal acceptance, even if not every psak is accepted. There's shuls across the world that have daily shiurim in Mishnah Brura, and other svarim that he wrote that I'll mention as well. And above all, he gained the reputation that he abhorred, but on which we should reflect, as a tzaddik. The stories about him are legendary. If only half of them are true, then we're discussing one of the holiest, saintliest people of his generation and probably many generations. The story of an American reporter came to visit him in Rodden to interview him late in life. And he, I think it was a woman, but I don't remember correctly for sure, but he refused to be interviewed by anybody, all right? And the most they did was allow her to glimpse him through the through his window of his hovel. And she wrote in her piece that, you know, forgive her language, but she said that she caught a glimpse of the Jewish God. All right? Very pagan, you understand where they're coming from. But what she saw in his visage was something that was not part of the natural world. He was renowned for his piety and sensitivity to others. One point we'll see later is even referenced by the Times in number 15 in the handout in their obituary of the Chafetz Chaim, that he closed his store. Look at the subtitle: "Lived long in poverty, gave up store when popularity in village deprived other merchants of a living." All right, that's a holy person. It became a well-known aphorism that Reb Chaim Brisker, Reb Chaim Soloveitchik, was such a gaon in Torah that people didn't realize what a tzaddik he was. While the Chafetz Chaim was such a tzaddik that people did not realize what a gaon in Torah he was. His personal righteousness was overshadowed. I'm sorry, his personal righteousness overshadowed his brilliance in Torah, and he was a genius, and he was a true Anav in every sense, but a sincere type of Anav. Not that there's any other type, but if you look at number one, there's a sefer that was published 100 years ago called Ar Leishem, from Shmuel Noach Gottlieb. He had a very interesting idea. to write mini biographies of every Gadol B'Torah in the world. So he mailed them all letters, all right, to ask for some biographical data, pedigree, etc. And that's what he printed. You see the Sefer online now. He comes to Chafetz Chaim and he writes, he wrote the Chafetz Chaim, he wrote the Mishnah Berurah, Od Harbei Svarim. He says the Svarim were accepted, B'chavivus Atzuma, with great love, U'v'tshuka Rabbah, Tvutzos Yisrael, with strong desire throughout the exile. He built a great yeshiva in his city, had hundreds of talmidim, etc., etc. Then number two, he writes, Omar Orech, the editor writes, Lo hizkarti boze af miktsas min amiktsas, mimauto amiti shalgon vatsarek hanizka boze. I only wrote the fraction of the essential greatness of this tzaddik. And he says what he omitted. And then if you skip down right to the middle, he says this is the letter that he received back from the Chafetz Chaim. Hod Maloso, your majesty, this is the Chafetz Chaim's writing. Kibalti michtavo, I received your letter. Umeot hayisi chafetz lemalot bakashat kvot tartarma. I would be very desirous to fulfill your will to answer you about my life. Avol yididi kasheli adavar zeh, my friend, it's very difficult for me. Kikfar nitparsem shmi arbe yoter min amido neged ratzoni. My name has already become more famous against my will, and it's not appropriate. Ve'echu chal liot batzmi goreim od pirsum al yidei ktivat kol chiburai. How can I cause myself even more renown by writing to you the other tzvarim that I wrote? Shotzeitim rak bizchut klal Yisrael. He didn't write them for himself. He wrote them for the Jewish people. V'chohen is all the reasons why he's not going to tell him a word about himself. So what the author did, he just compiled the generalities that everybody knew of the Chafetz Chaim's life, but he thought how wonderful it would be to include that letter from the Chafetz Chaim about how he does not want to be known. And he's certainly not going to add anything to what has to be said, because the exact opposite of his personality. He eschewed interviews, photographs, publicity of any kind. It caused him pain. So for example, when Radin became part of Poland after World War I, the Chafetz Chaim in 1923 endeavored to travel to Vienna for the Knesset Gedolah of Agudas Yisrael. We'll get back to that a little later as well. But he didn't have a passport. He never left. Then it was Russia, Lithuania most of the time. And he lacked a birth certificate. And he lacked even a proof of date of birth. So he went down to apply for a passport, and they believed the date that he told them. And they granted him a passport without affixing his photograph. Such was his renown already then, and he just out of humility refused to be photographed. And he could not state an occupation on his application because he never formally attained smicha. And he felt it was not appropriate to write rabbi when he hadn't gotten smicha. So in his 80s, Reb Chaim Ozer Grzynski granted him a letter of smicha. So he wrote on the application that he's a rabbi. He never wore rabbinic garb, nor did he wear a rabbinic hat. He wore more of a cap, sometimes a low one, sometimes a higher one, preferring the simple cap that was worn by laymen in Russia and Poland. No, everybody knows this picture, correct? According to most accounts, not all, most accounts, that's not the Chafetz Chaim. That's rather the butcher in Radin, who look like him. And when the Chafetz Chaim was requested to sit for a photograph, he sent the photographer to the butcher, or had the butcher come to his house so they could take a picture of him. There are very, very few pictures of the Chafetz Chaim extant, and I have one of them here. And you'll see there's a general resemblance. There's also, they found, I think this came out 2 or 3 years ago, a 14-second video clip of the Chafetz Chaim walking into the Knesset Gedolah in Vienna, surrounded by people, and with his eyes down and his hands together, walking like an Onov, does not want to be seen. But this was the Chafetz Chaim walking. It's probably from the 1920s as well. One second. He's the one in the middle. Looks like a butcher. Nothing wrong with that. And I blew up the picture to get a little different image of his visage. And it's really the only picture taken of him in which his eyes are up, as if he didn't know that there was a camera in front of him. He is just a blown-up picture of the Chafetz Chaim. As you can see from here, he never reached 5 feet tall. He was very short, and this already I heard from my grandfather, my mother's father. He told me that as a teenager, he once went to Warsaw because they were told that the Chafetz Chaim was coming to Warsaw. And thousands of Jews went to the train stations, a throng of people, and the Chafetz Chaim disembarked, and nobody could see him because he was so short. So against his will, they lifted him on their shoulders. And that's a glimpse that my grandfather saw of the Chafetz Chaim. He was a Rosh Yeshiva for a short time. He was a founder of the Yeshiva in Radin, one of the true Gedolim of his generation, the one to whom all other Gedolim, including the one of Chaim Ozer, turned to for advice and guidance and leadership and counsel and comfort and even insight into the future. And he personally taught some of the Gedolim of the next generation, and people wear his mantle until today. So who was the Chafetz Chaim? How was he produced? What was his legacy? He who became widely known throughout the Jewish world, it's still called today in Israel, Saba Kadisha, the Holy Elder, the Holy Zeta. So Chafetz Chaim was born on the 11th of Shvat. In fact, his birthday is later this week. The 11th of Shvat, as best can be determined, it was in 1839 or 1838. Seems like 1839. Not, by the way, as the Times recorded it. I just brought this as an example. The lie and fail in New York Times was wrong even back then. He didn't die at 105. He wasn't born in 1833. But all right, you can't expect a newspaper like the Times to get facts right even back then. He was born in Zhetel, which was in Grodno. Zhetel is about 80 miles northeast of Pruzhino. By coincidence, the same birthplace as the Dubna Magid. He was the son of Rabbi Aryeh Zeva Cohen and his second wife. His second wife, Rabbi Aryeh Zev, married the sister of his first wife, who died young. It's a recurring pattern in the Chafetz Chaim's life. So his father had been a Talmud in Volozhin, and then he became a shopkeeper in Zhetel and a tutor. His mother, Dobrusha, was a tzedekes, always davening, always learning Chumash, saying Tehillim. Many years later, a nephew brought the Chafetz Chaim, when he was in his 80s, his mother's little Tehillim. And as he held it, he started to cry. And he said, "Do you know how many tears my mother cried into this Tehillim, praying that her little son should grow up to be a good and honest Jew, an Erlich Hayid?" By the way, that itself is Musar. Note what she davened for, that he should be an Erlich Jew, nothing else. He was an Ely from a young age. He also had a very keen sense of justice. The story's told. He was a little kid. He was with his friends. They saw the apple seller's cart overturned. Apples went flying. And they all ran to grab some apples before the woman seller could retrieve them. Soon after, he was learning with his father about Losignov. As soon as he learned that, he went to his mother, asked her for a kopek, a small coin. He went back to the saleswoman, asked for a kopek's worth of apples. She put the apples in a bag, gave it to him, he paid her the kopek, and then he dumped all the apples back in the barrel and he ran off. Shouldn't be accused of gezel. He was orphaned at 10 years of age. His father had gone to Vilna and unfortunately was ensnared in the great cholera epidemic of 1849, from the service of Solanta from back then. His father was 46 years old. After he died, his mother remarried and moved to Vilna. And so he went to learn, the Chofetz Chaim did where his father learned, and he came under the tutelage of, among others, his main Rebbe, Rabbi Yaakov Barit, and Rabbi Shlomo HaKohen of Vilna, known as the Cheshek Shlomo. In Vilna, he was, as a teenager, he was enticed by the Maskilim, who saw his brilliance and his youth, but he resisted their entreaties to join their yeshiva. They had a Maskilim yeshiva in Vilna, as is well known. Not altogether implausible, his family then sought to marry him off, maybe just to protect him. And here too the Chofetz Chaim's greatness emerged. He was a kid, he was 16 years old. By this time his mother had moved back to Rodin with her second husband, and her new husband decided to set up his own daughter Freda from his first marriage with his 16-year-old stepson, Rabbi Yisrael Meir. The Chofetz Chaim mother opposed it for a number of reasons, and a big fight ensued. He had no idea about any of this. Only learned about it when he came from Vilna. His stepfather invited him to come back from Vilna to Radin for Yom Tov, and his stepfather then suggested the shidduch to the Chofetz Chaim. It was not ideal. For one thing, he had little money. Secondly, she was actually older, Freda, than the Chofetz Chaim was. But when he saw the fighting it was causing and the threat to his mother, Shalom Bayis, the Chofetz Chaim agreed to marry her. His older stepbrother, meaning his own father's son from his father's first marriage, knowing the Chofetz Chaim was a great catch for any wealthy family, and they had no money at all, tried to preempt the Tanoim and race back wherever he was to Radin to prevent the Tanoim from taking place. Alas, his coach broke down, flat tire. He came too late. The Tanoim were signed, and the Chofetz Chaim refused to break off the shidduch, which, of course, would have hurt his mother's marriage, as well as shamed the girl. So they married, and happily so. They married almost 45 years. And even though his father-in-law's, his stepfather-slash-father's business failed, and he never was really able to pay much of the dowry. No matter, he was 17 years old when he married. He spent his time learning, but soon he fled Radin for Lida when a rabbinic controversy broke out in Radin in which he wanted no part. He was offered a rabbinic position, he refused it, and then he reluctantly accepted the position as the Rav of Radin, but only briefly when his decision in the Din Torah was dismissed by the losing litigant, he returned his contract and said, I had enough of the rabbinate. Happens. He was in his early 20s at the time, and would never again hold any rabbinic position. Ironically, he wound up and having even greater impact on the Jewish people because he was not bound to any one position. You know, it remains a truism today in the rabbinic world. The most influential rabbis, at least the rabbis who are most famous and outspoken, not always for good, I'll add, are almost never encumbered by any organizational tie except for the ones they themselves create. They'll make their own organization, then they can do whatever they want. So what the Chofetz Chaim did was endeavor to take Torah to the people, writing Svarim and teaching Torah from town to town. In a famous parable, and of course the initial impetus was to counter the Haskalah, famous parable, Chofetz Chaim loved parables, Mishalim, just like his landsman, the Dubna Magid. There was a woman selling apples on the street, and a band of hooligans started grabbing apples from her barrel. And she started to scream and cry until a man said to her, Nara Shafroi, why are you crying? Crying won't help. They're grabbing apples, so you grab some too. This way you'll also have some. So Chofetz Chaim said, we can't just scream and cry about the Haskalah, about losing Jews. Go do something about it. Spread Torah. Live an honest Torah life. And the masses will see the great value and beauty of Torah. So a great idea in theory. In practice, the Chofetz Chaim was impoverished. You can't make a living with dreams. And his only earnings at the time, in his early 20s, came from what he made as a tutor. He vehemently refused gifts, charity. In fact, he prided himself. He never ate in someone's house. even though we'll see he was an inveterate traveler for many years. At his wife's urging, they decided to open up a grocery store, and he had in Rotten. He inherited some money from an aunt. They bought a store that his wife ran while he learned in the Beis Medrash, and he came on market days to help out, and he kept the books as well. People flocked to his store, Jews and non-Jews. He had a reputation for honesty, and as a Talmud Chacham. So this is what the Times obituary references. At first, business was so good because of who he was, people wanted to help him. The Chafetz Chaim said, we have to close the front door of the store, the one that faces the street. So people who live here, they'll know it again through the back. Otherwise, it's not fair to the other merchants. Only the regulars would come. Then he said, we have to close at noon, after we made some money for the day, so that other merchants make a living as well. They bought a cow to sell milk, until he decided to close the store completely. And that's what the Times references. Non-Jews were his eager customers. Once a non-Jew on market day left behind one herring that the Chafetz Chaim had sold him from a batch that he had sold. He didn't know who the non-Jew was. On the next market day, he gave every non-Jew a free herring to make sure that he wouldn't have any gezo. He was obsessive on not cheating anyone, Jew or non-Jew. 1865, still broke, barely 25 years old, he was appointed a Rosh Yeshiva in Vashilashok, near Vilna. He was there for 4 years. He returned to Raden, and then young people already started to come to him to learn. They would eat in people's homes, they learned in the Beis Medrash, they would sleep in the Beis Medrash, and he would be their Rebbe, mainly teenagers. The Chafetz Chaim developed a close and warm bond with all of them. And it was then that he endeavored to revive the laws of Shmiras HaLashon, long neglected, or to which lip service was paid, forgive the pun. Part of the problem was that there were very few halachic works that dealt with this area in detail. And even the Talmud references are scattered about. It's not like Shabbos or Sukkah or Nida. You want to study the area, so you go to the Masechta. You want to learn Kashrus, you go to Chulin. The laws of Lashon Hara are found mainly in two dafim in Arachin, and isolated statements in Sanhedrin, Babasra, Metzia, a few other places. Rabbeinu Bachya's Chovas HaLevavos dealt with it. Rabbeinu Yonah Shari Tshuva dealt with it, but only as topics within a larger work. There was no one work devoted to the laws of Lashon Hara. And yet, the Gemara speaks about it as really epitomizing the sensitivity of a Jew. Look at number 3, is the beginning of the discussion in Arachin Daf Tesvav Amid Beis. Omer B'Yochanan, Mishum B'Yossi Barton Zimra, Mayi Dichsiv, Mayi Ten Lecho, Umayi Yosef Loch Lashon Remiyah, a Pasuk in Tehillim, Kufchav, what can I give you, deceitful tongue? Amar LaKadosh Baruch Hu Lashon. God said to the tongue, Kolei Varav Shalom Skufim Vatamutol. All of man's other limbs are upright. You're flat. Kolei Varav Mi Bachutz. Everything is on the exterior. You're inside. V'lo Od. Not only that, but I surrounded you with two walls. You're surrounded by a wall of Etzem, the jaw. Achashal Basar, the cheek. What else can I add to you to get you to control your tongue? That's the drasha on the pasuk. Or Rabbi Yochanan, Mishum Rabbi Yossi ben Zimra, call a mesaper lashon hara keilu kafar beikar. You speak lashon hara, it's as if you denied God. You speak lashon hara, God says, Ein ani v'hu yichalim ladur ba'olam. I can't live in the same universe as the Baal lashon hara. Talmud Rabbi Shmuel, Kol HaMesaper Lashon Hara, Magdil Avonos Keneged Shalosh Averos. That sin is as great as the three cardinal sins of idolatry, immorality, and homicide as well. So Chafetz Chaim wrote the work, the eponymous work became associated with his name, based on this Gemara number 4 in Avodah Zarah, Daf Yotes Amud Beis. Machriz Rabbi Alexandre, Alexander, walked in the marketplace and yelled out, Man Baichai, Man Baichai, who wants to live? Who wants to live? Who wants to live? Everybody wants to live. Everybody came to him. Who doesn't want life? Amrile Havlon Chaye. So Rabbi Alexandria said to them, I'll give you life. Amar Lahu. So they said to him, give us life. He said, okay, I'll give you life. Quotes the pasuk we say every Shabbos morning in the Pesukah Zimra. Mi Oisha Chafetz Chayim. Oh, if Yamim Liros Tov, who is the one who desires life, who loves his days to see good? Nitzor Lashon Chamera. It's the one who guards his tongue from evil. Usfasecha Midaber Mirma. And his lips from speaking deceit. Sur Merav Asay Tov. Bakay Shomer Feu. Veer from evil and do good. Seek out peace. Chase after it. Mi Ha'ish HaChofetz Chaim. It took a few years to write. It was a systematic discussion of the laws of Lashon Hara and Rechilus, the similar but not identical, and underscoring that Lashon Hara only applies to true statements that will tend to disparage the subject. And this is how he begins in number 5 at the bottom of the page. In Sefer Chofetz Chaim, Aleph, Aleph. Aser l'saper b'gnus chavero afilu al emes gomur. You're not allowed to talk disparagingly about another, even if it is completely true. And he organized the Sefer into klolim and seifim with examples and sources, and he developed the so-called exceptions to the rules, also based on the Gemara in a few places, kol milta mit amram ba'ape mora, anything that you would say in front of the subject himself, or anything you would say b'api tolosa in front of three people, or where there's a toeles to relate the Lashon Hara, a benefit. What's the benefit? No, not that it feels good to say it, but there's 7 prerequisites that have to be met to permit Lashon Hara. First-hand knowledge, no ulterior motive, possible harm to others, and no other way to avert that harm, no exaggeration, won't cause more harm to the subject than halacha requires. That's all in Klal Yud. And he discussed the laws of Avak Lashon Hara, the dust of Lashon Hara, hinting at something disparaging, joking about it, double meanings, and even one example that's more well known, not that it's observed, the Isser to praise someone generally. You praise someone, that would be someone in the crowd to say, yes, but, all right? Don't praise people. And certainly don't praise someone in front of an enemy of that person, because that person will then become angered, riled up, and right away speak Lashon Hara about him. Even the Gemara's Heter, Ba'api Tlato, the 3 people there, exists only because we assume a Jew would not talk Lashon Hara to a group for fear that the subject will find out. Obviously, it's not allowed if the speaker doesn't care that the subject finds out, or wants the subject to find out, or the information is Gnai Gamur. There's so many details. You know, it's also forbidden to listen to it, forbidden to believe it. You can be cautious because of it, but you can't believe it. But one is allowed to investigate a shidduch or a potential business partner. But there too, there's an art in how to convey information that protects the interlocutor, the party who wants the information, without defaming the subject. He always tried to limit the leniencies because Lashon Hara is a plague. For example, you can disparage, it's mutter, you can disparage and not be karis, but only if you heard it yourself, not from others. He was faithful to the Gemara, to the Rishonim. It's a massive compilation. In one famous vignette we've discussed in the past, Rav Yisrael Salanter at first refused to give a haskama to the Sefer Chafetz Chaim because of one halacha. The Chafetz Chaim wrote in Klal Dalet Sif Yud Beis that to repent, to do tshuva for Lashon Hara, if the subject does not know about it, you have to ask him for forgiveness and tell him what you said. I do that every Erev Yom Kippur when people ask me for mechila. What'd you say? I'd like to know. Rabbi Yisrael could not accept that because that would cause more harm to the victim. And he said, your tshuva cannot entitle you to cause more harm to the other person. So even the Chafetz Chaim tried to say to him, that's the halacha recorded in the Shari Tshuva, Rabbeinu Yonah. It's hard to say. I looked up the text. Rabbeinu Yonah said, Im Yoshu Bal Haloshim B'tshuva, Tzarech Levakesh Mechila L'Asher Mutzak Lo Mizam L'Shono. You have to ask Mechila from the person. He doesn't quite say. You have to tell him exactly what you said. So, Chafetz Chaim found 17 prohibitions potentially violated when one speaks Lashon Hara, and negating 14 mitzvahs aseh when you speak Lashon Hara. That's a lot of Torah. That's a lot of mitzvahs. It was a novel idea that was it's still hard for people to accept even today. But nonetheless, the Chafetz Chaim was fond of quoting the Gemara in Chulin, Daf Pei Tes Amud Aleph, Ma Umanoso Shel Odom Olam Hazeh. What should be a person's tactic or craft in this world? Yasim Atzmo Ke'ilem. Make yourself like a mute. We're much better off not talking than talking. Better to be silent, except in Divrei Torah. And it's critical to understand the Chafetz Chaim was not a recluse. And he did not shy away from human contact at all, but he knew intuitively when Lashon Hara was about to be uttered, enough to gently silence the other person. When it was published in 1873 in Vilna, the Chafetz Chaim went on a book tour, so to speak, trying to sell the sefer from town to town. He was too self-effacing to be a salesman or a promoter. Note, the sefer was published anonymously. He kept his name out of it, his real name. And the haskamos that he got omitted his name as well. And each town that he visited to sell the book, he just claimed to be the agent of the author. He didn't dress as a Rosh Yeshiva. And he would speak about the book between Mincha Ma'ariv, and then he would sell it for the price that he had determined. And he refused to take a kopeck more than the price it was to be sold at. In many communities, he was outed. It became too obvious. The Rav immediately sensed that the young man before him was not just an agent. He knew too much. So, for example, in Griva, in Latvia, Rav Cook's father, Rav Shlomo Zalman Cook, was the Rav. He figured him out in 10 minutes who he was, that he was the author, and he helped him sell throughout the community. In another town, he was also found out. Remember, by then he was known as Rashiv and Radin also. A man gave him a 100-ruble note for a sefer he was charging a ruble for as the coach was leaving. He said, I'll buy a book. He gave the book. He gave him a bill. The bill was 100. The next town, the Chafetz Chaim realized the error. He went back to the first town. He went back to the shul. He pleaded that the one who gave him the money in error should take it back and claim it. No one did. He again said, and now with tears in his eyes, crying, he cannot steal from a Jew. He cannot take any money that's undeserved from a Jew. And then the man approached and he said he just wanted to give the Chafetz Chaim some extra money. And the Chafetz Chaim gave him back his 100 rubles. His travel stories were legendary. He was once traveling by wagon with his books, and he was always unknown because he traveled incognito. The wagon driver stopped to rest. Chafetz Chaim disembarked to stretch. And while he was there, so the driver, you know, saw this peasant Jew was traveling with him. He decided to have a little fun with him. While the Chafetz Chaim was stretching, he took off to the next town. Chafetz Chaim trudged the next town with his box, with his satchel of svarim, and he sought out the driver because he realized he hadn't yet paid him for the trip. Another time on a train, a Jewish farmer spoke on a journey of several hours about his farm and his feed and his crops and his animals. And the Chafetz Chaim was listening intently and they were dialoguing, conversing. When they arrived at the destination, the man saw a big crowd come to greet the wagon, and the Chafetz Chaim got off and he realized who he was and he apologized to him for wasting his time. And the Chafetz Chaim answered, on the contrary, I haven't enjoyed such a conversation in a long time. 4 hours, and not even a fear that a word of Lashon Hara will be uttered. It was all about animals and crops. I thank you. Another time, a fellow passenger robbed him of 400 rubles and ran off. There are different endings to the story. One story is the Chafetz Chaim disembarks and starts yelling, Hefker, 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 meaning he's declaring his money ownerless, so the man shouldn't be a ganav. Another ending to the story, or maybe it happened a few times, he yelled to another passenger, started to chase the man, don't chase him, maybe he needs the money to marry off an aging daughter. That was the Chafetz Chaim. The book was revolutionary. and it really destroyed the Chafetz Chaim's goal of anonymity. It's not as if every detail of the book was embraced, not then or now, but it became the indispensable resource, and it was followed 3 years later, 1876, with the publication of a companion volume called Sefer Shmiras HaLashon, which is a study of the Musar of the Mitzvah. Why is it important? Why is it so difficult to overcome? How to overcome the constant urge to speak Lashon Hara? So he became one of those great Jews whose name is less known than the Sefer that he wrote, the Chafetz Chaim. He was once riding on a train, and a Jew asked him where he's from. He said, first Gradna, then what town? Radin. Radin, oh, you have a great tzaddik in that town, the Chafetz Chaim, he should live and be well. And the Chafetz Chaim said, he's not such a tzaddik, he's a pashut yid, he's a simple, plain Jew. And the man became enraged. He was screaming and cursing at this old Jew next to him. And when they got to the town, people came to greet the Chafetz Chaim, and the man was humiliated, and he asked the Chafetz Chaim for forgiveness. So I've heard two endings to the story as well. Again, maybe it happened several times. One, the Chafetz Chaim said to him, I don't understand what there was to forgive. You called me a tzaddik. What can I complain about? But the second ending is, the Chafetz Chaim said he learned the halacha from here, that you're not allowed to say Lashon Hara even about yourself. And he apologized to the man for doing that. The Sefer Chafetz Chaim Shmiras HaLashon became a staple in many yeshivas. In Merkaz, for example, Ratzi Yehuda gave students a lot of leeway as to what they could learn. It's very flexible, except for one mandatory shiur. Every day, 12:45 to 1:15, there was a Seder in these two Svarim, Shmiras HaLashon and Sefer Chafetz Chaim. It was mandatory. Like anything mandatory anywhere, yeshiva or not, it became a little lax over time. They stopped showing, and Reb Tzvi Yehuda HaKohen Kuk stopped giving his regular shiurim. He boycotted the yeshiva, and he began fasting as well. Talmidim complained to his sister, what's going on? And she asked him, and he said he has to do tshuva, because the Gemara says in Brachos, Kol Odom Sheesh Bo Yirat Shamayim Dvarav Nishmoyim. Any person has Yirat Shamayim, so people listen to him. If his students are not listening to him, it means he has no Yirat Shamayim, so he has to do tshuva, he has to fast. They restored the shir. Ratzi Yehuda held that this mitzvah was the key to a Jew's ethical perfection. It was the Chafetz Chaim who resuscitated it. Every Shmiras HaLashon campaign is in his chus. And think about it this way. You've heard the expression Shmiras HaLashon. He coined the expression. It's based on a fragment of a pasuk in Mishlei, but the phrase was almost never used before he used it. That is an enduring influence. He basically created a topic, a subject of study, a category in Jewish life, Shmiras HaLashon, and his reputation grew. Grew so much, he was getting offers to move to bigger cities, but he insisted on staying in Radin, a small, poor town. He felt small town, small Yetzer Hara. Big town, big Yetzer Hara. He was never the Rav of the town except that brief time. He ran the yeshiva for a short time, but he ran the yeshiva. And he was the Gabbai Tzedakah for Radin. And he took it upon himself to check the weights and measures of the merchants for accuracy. The yeshiva opened in 1869 informally, no building, grew, but the conditions under which the students lived were Spartan. Radin was a poor town. Chafetz Chaim had no money, would travel to raise funds. He would occasionally send his top students to other yeshivos where he felt the more comfortable conditions, it's all relative, would enable them to learn better. In 1883, he brought in his oldest son-in-law, Rav Hirsch Levinson, as Rosh Yeshiva. And in 1900, Rav Moshe Landinsky, and soon after, Rav Naftali Trapp, all famous names, became the Rosh Yeshiva in the Chafetz Chaim's Yeshiva, which was called Yeshiva's Chafetz Chaim, because of the Sefer, not because of him. Rabbi Yerucham Lvovitz, for example, we quote him all the time, was a Mashkiach, was a Talmud of Chafetz Chaim Mashkiach, before he moved to Mir. A new building was built in 1904. The golden age of the yeshiva began. A bigger building in 1913, which the Chafetz Chaim raised 15,000 rubles. At its peak, it had about 300 students learning there, and many famous Talmidim, some I mentioned already, but Rabbi Chanan Wasserman, Hashem Kom Damo, Rabbi Yosef Shlomo Kahanim, the Panovich Arav, the Rosh Yeshiva, they were all Talmidim of the Chafetz Chaim. Interestingly, the Chafetz Chaim did not follow the Seder, a formal teaching of Musar that was popularized by the Alter of Slobodka. He refused to take sides in the great Musar War of 1897, I discussed once here at the Shal Shudas, whether it should be formally taught almost on a par with Gemara. He supported the Alter. At the same time, he didn't have a large or long formal shir because he obviously endorsed studying Musar every day as long as it wasn't the primary focus and didn't detract from Talmud Torah. He said Musar fortified Jews against the strong winds of heresy, but it's like a coat. The garment is still Talmud Torah. So in Radin, they just learned Musar for 30 minutes after Maariv. 1915, with just 2 years after the new building was built, World War I was raging, and the German and Russian armies were nearing Radin. Chafetz Chaim didn't know what to do, so he split the yeshiva in two. One group stayed in Radin with Rav Moshe Landinsky, and the Chafetz Chaim and Rabbi Chanan went into exile. First in Smilovitz, and then he continued, he had to flee further east. Very suffer from the communist revolution. Yeshiva didn't reunite in Radin, now in Poland, until 1921, 6 years later. And in that year, sadly, his son-in-law and top assistant, Rav Hirsch Levinson, died after a short illness. But the Chafetz Chaim had not functioned as a Rosh Yeshiva formally since 1883, and although he gave a shir in the yeshiva, he turned his attention to writing and to communal leadership. The truth is, if he had only written the Sefer Chafetz Chaim, his reputation would have been secured. But he wrote important works, all in line with his personality and midos, and all to appeal to the common Jew. So, for example, in 1881, he wrote a famous and invaluable work called Machne Yisrael, a guide for the Jewish soldier serving in a foreign army, to wit, the Tsar's army. You have it here in number 11, the Hakadama to Machne Yisrael. And he writes, of course, he had to dodge the censor. So the section I have in front of you, V'chei mitzuvim anachnu le'ahov es ha-melech b'ava shleimo v'emunah l'sva b'shlomo shel malchus. We have to love the king, the Tsar, pray for the king, pray for the kingdom as well. And he says, why ain't the oven gadol hu l'shtamet me'avodas hatzavu mikamofanim? He said it's a great iniquity to shirk military service for a number of reasons. First, the schus he gives us for living here, and he protects us. And what's the problem? You want to put on tefillin? We're allowed to put on tefillin. You want to be able to not eat tray food? You cannot eat tray food. You can read the whole thing. So that was the introduction, but the basics of the Sefer was how to retain Jewish observance in a hostile environment, with an overview of mitzvos and midos, so the Jewish soldier could carry this with him, learn a little Torah every day, and feel connected. Obviously, he was mindful of the censor, which is why he's so lavish with the Tsar. But chapter 1 underscores how every Jewish soldier is as good as any other Jew, and they should never think otherwise. And then he has discussions of every halachic issue that a soldier might encounter, and an encouragement about morality, a warning against gaiva, stealing, etc. They're fascinating stories about the kindness with which the Chafetz Chaim dealt with Jewish soldiers, advising them and assisting them. It's a story I heard from Rav Einer, it's written up by Rav Tzvi Yehuda as well, that he told the story that a young draftee approached the Chafetz Chaim and asked, as was common, should he mutilate his trigger finger? Because then you'd get out of serving in the army, couldn't shoot. And the Chafetz Chaim, Tzvi Yehuda said no, that the day will come, we have to fight for the land of Israel. So you'll be needed, and we must learn the art of war. All right. When I wrote this in my third book, it provoked a very hostile reaction from some people in Israel, but I sourced it, and that's what the Chafetz Chaim said. Once the Chafetz Chaim was staying at an inn, and a burly, gruff man walked in, sat down, and in a brusque and vulgar, decadent manner, ordered food from the waitress with some whiskey. He ate without washing, without saying any brachos, and he drank his whiskey like a peasant. The Chafetz Chaim was stunned, and he began to approach this person, and the innkeeper begged him to say nothing. And he said this man was a cantonist. He was chapped, 8 years old, by the Tsar from his home, sent for 10 years to Siberia, and then age 18 was conscripted for 25 years of service in the Tsar's army. So he had very little Jewish education, and people were afraid of him as Bulvan. Chafetz Chaim said, let me talk to him. And he approached him, and he said to this man, is it really true that you were kidnapped as a boy and raised among Gentiles and not able to learn Torah at all? And yet, you didn't convert, but you remained a Jew. I wish I had merits like yours, because in the next world, you'll be placed among the truly righteous, a Jew who suffered such terrible ordeals for his faith. The man started to cry, and when he found out who this little Jew was, he embraced him. And the Chafetz Chaim said to him, imagine what merits you will have if you dedicate yourself to observing the mitzvot the rest of your life. And the man attached himself to the Chafetz Chaim, and he learned to live as a Jew. He decided to write a commentary on Orach Chaim. Literally food for the soul, I should say figuratively food for the soul in the area of Jewish life that guides us daily. If you look at number 7, it's the Akdama to the Mishnah Brura, he says, Ayotze midvareinu, shatar kadosha, hi bepshitas mazon ruchani la nefesh, kamalechem shu mazon laguf. That Torah is the spiritual sustenance for our souls, just like we eat bread for our bodies. And therefore, each day we need the sustenance. And he wrote about Orach Chaim, look at number 8, Nilfiza nir be'alil, dechelek Orach Chaim v'ayose, muktam l'liman l'chol af seichel. He says, this chelek of Shulchan Aruch, Orach Chaim, the first tour, is the first of the four chalakim, and even though all four are needed in practice, this comes first, because knowing it is vital, because a Jew encounters the laws of Orach Chaim every day. Ubilado, without it, he can't move a foot, move a hand. So he started with waking up in the morning, tefillah, Shabbos, Yom Tov, all the way through Purim. First volume went up to Birchas Kohanim. He received Haskamos from the Gedolei Hador Kum, Rabbi Yitzchak Yochanan Spector. He published the first volume in 1883. He didn't publish it all at once. Couldn't afford it. And then he went again, traveling town to town, selling volume 1, speaking again in shuls between Mincha and Maariv. It took him almost 25 years to finish what became 6 volumes, which is now a staple in every Jewish home that cares about Torah. And it's a resource for everyone who learns halacha. He explains in the Mishnah Berurah, the Shulchan Aruch offers reasons, sources, other opinions. And the Bir Halacha along the side, he demonstrates his full mastery of the Rishonim and Achronim and the various opinions that translate into common practice. I mentioned Agavurcha, the Aruch HaShulchan, Yichud Michal Levi Epstein, came out shortly after the final volume of the Mishnah Berurah is published. But it's more of a restatement of the Shulchan Aruch than it is a commentary with the background and commentary and other opinions including the text itself and without the Shulchan Aruch printed there at all. So, for your learning pleasure, I just cited the very first Mishnah Berurah in the Shulchan Aruch. The Shulchan Aruch begins in number 9. Yiskaber Ka'ari La'amod Baboker La'avodas Boro Shehehu Me'or HaShachar. A person should gird his strength like a lion to arise in the morning to the service of his Creator, he should be the one awaking the dawn, not vice versa. That's the Rabbi Yosef Karo. In number 10, the Chafetz Chaim comments, Lavodas boro ki lekach nivra ha'adam. That's why man was created. Kal nirka b'shmi l'chodi brasiv. Ve'afim yashienu yitzro b'choref lomar. Eich tamo baboker, even if your yetzara arises in the winter, in the cold of winter, to say to you, how are you going to get up? Why go out of the house? Ki akor gadol, it's too cold. Or he'll try to seduce you in the summer, saying, how are you getting up? Adai lo savata mishnascha, the days are longer, sunrise is early, you didn't sleep enough. Yizgaber alav, you should triumph over that, vayishmalo, and not listen to it. The yachsho benavsho, ilu hoya nitzrach lamad l'shos lufnei ha-melech basar v'dom, kama hiya zohir v'zoriz lamad bachkama l'chin atzma l'avodaso. You should think how easy it would be to get up if you knew the king awaited your service. Years ago from Rabbi Wein, this tale, the Chafetz Chaim, he was in his early 90s, he was already weak, and he got up, and he was too weak to get out of bed. And he said to himself, you know, I'm 90 years old. If I don't make it to shul in the morning, who's going to say anything about me? Who's going to complain? So he put his head back down and pulled the blanket, and then he gave a clop, and he said, that was my Yetzirah. My Yetzirah is also 90 years old, but it got up a few minutes before me. So then he jumped out of bed to begin his day. That's the Chafetz Chaim. In 1885, he published Avas Chesed, which is a primer of halacha and musar on all the various types of chesed that a Jew can perform, from lending money, giving tzedakah, hachnasas orchem, nicham aveilim, and everything else that defines our lives. He was a master in all of this with exquisite sensitivity. I'll tell you a story. When I was learning in Israel, I once ate Friday night at the home of a Rav in Netanya. My brother may remember, Rabbi Cohn was the rabbi of my grandparents' shul. So as I recall, he quickly sang Shalom Aleichem, and then he made Kiddush. And after Kiddush, we washed for our motzi, we ate bread, and then he sang Eish Yischaiel, Ribon Kolomim, etc. And I asked, you know, politely about the minig. So he said that when I was your age, I was 17, he was a guest in the Chafetz Chaim's house in Raden, learning in the yeshiva then. And he said, this is what the Chafetz Chaim did whenever he had guests, Friday night, because he feared that the guests might be hungry. So how can he sing songs and make a long Kiddush? He's just causing pain to people who are hungry. So he said, he's doing the same for me. I don't know if I looked hungry, but nonetheless, that was his minhag too. In 1893, he published Nidchei Yisrael, The Dispersed of Israel, a book for Jews who are emigrating to America. Think of his scope, all right? By then, the mass migrations had begun in the early 1880s. Jews were emigrating to America. Already the word had reached him that Jews arriving on American shores were casting away Torah and mitzvos. So the book is in Hebrew and Yiddish. Hebrew on top, Yiddish on the bottom. It's a synopsis of the basic mitzvos and ideas of Judaism, and the bracha that accrues to every faithful Jew. It was written in a simple language for simple Jews. It was another unique dimension of the Chafetz Chaim. He didn't only speak to Talmid HaChachamim. His focus really was the simple Jew, the focus of his intellectual and spiritual energy, and that was demonstrated in the Svarim that he wrote. He wrote over a dozen other Svarim as well. His last, the two-volume Sefer HaMitzvos HaKotzar, it's a listing of Taryag with a brief description so people could carry it in their pockets and read it on the train or commuting. It was published in 1931 when the Chafetz Chaim was 92 years old. With all his compassion and sensitivity, life in Europe and the news from America educated him about the heretical winds that were blowing, and the Chafetz Chaim did not spare these heretics, especially the reform in Europe and America, his contempt. To him, the Torah was so obviously the Dvar Hashem, he couldn't bear the sophistries of the heretics of his day and their complaints against the Torah and its failure to modernize, as they would say. So in one mashal, he said, The man who once ran down the main street of a town screaming that the tallest building is wobbling and about to fall. And a panic ensued. People didn't see it and they didn't know where to run. As one chacham stood to the side watching, unperturbed, and he told the people, go find an eye doctor. They said, what are you talking about? The building is about to fall on us. And the chacham explained, you really believe that this mighty building with its strong foundation is about to collapse? Of course not. It just looks wobbly to this fellow because his eyes are trembling. They're moving about in their sockets. Get him a doctor to treat him and he'll be fine. He said, so too, people think the Torah is collapsing. It's only because they're lacking spiritual vision. They don't see its eternity, its eternal relevance or value in every generation. So it's a waste of time to argue with heretics, the Reform, who were ignorant of Torah, unlike some of the Maskilim, or at least knew some Torah. But you have to reach out to the Jews and you'll find a ready audience. And the truth is, all the successes and failures of Torah since that time are attributable to the extent to which we have reached out to other Jews who are not raised with Torah. So Chafetz Chaim also became one of the preeminent Jewish leaders of the late 19th and early 20th centuries. He was in the forefront of those who combated the Haskalah, who would travel with delegations to meet the Tsar's officials to alleviate the decrees against Jewish education, rights of residency, founding and building new yeshivas to educate a new generation. Interestingly, others were like this as well, despite the difficulty he had in sustaining his yeshiva in Radin, he regularly raised money for other yeshivas. He gave money to Rabbi Chanan to start the yeshiva in Baranovich. He personally saved the yeshiva of the Altman Slobodka from closing during the Great Mussar War in 1897 with an anonymous donation of 300 rubles. He was completely opposed to the introduction of secular studies in yeshivas, one of the hot topics of the day, or the requirement that rabbis, the government requirement, rabbis have a secular degree as well, and he joined with others to protest the degrees. But also, presciently, he advocated for women's Torah education, as mandatory elementary school education had been enacted, and he felt girls would otherwise be miseducated in public schools with all the attendant consequences that were noted already 100 years ago. So turn the page, look at number 12. You see this Ha'ara in his Likuta Halachos on Sota. V'nira dekol zeh. What the Mishnah says in Sota, you can't teach a girl Torah. Dafka bizmanim shelefaneinu. It's only past times. Shekol achor hayadar b'makam avosav v'kabos avosay chazak meod eisa kol echad v'echel esnag b'derash shadaru avosenu. In past generations, everybody lived together. Children lived in their parents' homes. They saw how they lived. Shalavicha v'yagedcha. So that's all true. But then we could say, Shel Tilmat Torah, they don't have to learn formally, and they could rely on the teachings, the guidance they got from their parents. Avol ka'es b'avosenu harabim, shekabala sa'avos nisrofeif ma'od ma'od. Now, the Mesorah itself is weakening. V'gamotzu yishenu dam makam avosav klal. And not everyone is living with their parents anymore. Ubefrato son shem ragil and atzmon lilmod ksav v'lashon ha'amim. And certainly not those who are going to other schools and learning foreign languages. So there it's clear, mitzvah rabba, you have to teach them chumish and nach and musar, like avos, benar samar, etc. Kedeshi yis'ames etzlam inyan emunaseinu hagadosha. You have to teach them everything so the true faith becomes rooted within them. Dilav hachi, if you don't do that, alul sheyasur legamrei miderech Hashem, they're going to stray from the path of God and violate all the yesodei hadas. So it's not known whether Sarah Schneer actually consulted him, had someone else consult him, or just relied on the Chafetz Chaim's intent. But no doubt he was a tacit and the later an active supporter of the Beis Yaakov movement. And you see, in fact, the number 13, the letter obviously came out in his name. It was the year of his death, where he gives his bracha to the work of the Beis Yaakov schools that girls should join there and study there and avoid the dangers of exposure to the outside world. He was a foe of Zionism, the Chafetz Chaim, even feared it, because he saw the secular Zionists were abandoning the Torah. So he opposed any cooperation. He opposed Mizrahi. He even once said to one of the founders of Mizrahi, Rav Yitzchak Yaakov Reines, the Rav of Lida, give it up and you will be turned to in every communal matter. And Rav Reines responded, no, it's a mitzvah for a Jew to be a Zionist. The Chafetz Chaim later traveled himself to Lida, it's not far from Radin, and he said to Rav Reines, you know, people always look for excuses. Someday, before the Kisei HaKavod, they'll ask you why you did what you did with Mizrahi, and you'll say, well, Yisrael Kagan lived near me, and he never protested. So here I am to tell you, do not use me as an excuse. But he loved the land of Israel, and he decided to make Aliyah in 1925. World War I and its difficulties had awakened him to the messianic moment, especially the aftermath, and he sensed that redemption was imminent, but that it would be preceded by great suffering. He assumed it was the tribulations of World War I. Indeed, the Chafetz Chaim had a knack for perceiving small events in their role in the cosmic scheme. So, for example, he was informed that radio had been invented, and he immediately understood its potential. He said, oh, when Mashiach comes, the whole world will now know about it instantly. That he saw as the value of radio. He inserted in the Tanoim for his three sons-in-law, the first in 1881 and the second in 1923, he'd support them for a number of years unless he made Aliyah. Then the deal is off and they accepted it. So he began planning his Aliyah in the early 1920s, was set to depart after Pesach 1925. Conference was held in Vienna of the Gedolim, and they pleaded with him not to go. I'm sorry, Vilna, not in Vienna. In Vilna, Reb Chaim Ozer said to him, a father cannot abandon his children. So he postponed it until Elul because his youngest daughter, Fega, the wife of Mendel Zaks, became ill on the day the Chafetz Chaim received his immigration papers. But then he wrote a farewell letter to the Jews of Poland. In the late summer, a delegation visited him in Radin, Reb Baruch Ber, Reb Ochan Vassaman, Reb Yerucham, and others, pleading with him to stay until after Sukkos. And the Chafetz Chaim said indignantly, I'm not under arrest. I'm allowed to travel. And then on the last day of Sukkos, his wife took seriously ill. Chafetz Chaim married twice. He was widowed the first time. She needed emergency surgery in Vilna, and again the trip was postponed. By the time she recovered, Chafetz Chaim, now in his late 80s, had weakened himself, and doctors came from Vilna to recommend he not travel to Israel, not good for his health. That's how his plans were thwarted. But concomitant with his opposition to Zionism was his love and respect for Rav Kook. By both accounts, both sides, it was the Chafetz Chaim who in the 1880s insisted that Rav Kook, who was wavering, not embark on a career in business, but enter the rabbinate. And the famous Aguda Knesa Gadol I mentioned at the very beginning, in August 1923, held in Vienna, the one that required him to get a passport and smicha, the Knesia Gadola, by the way, where Meir Shapir of Lublin introduced the Daf Yomi that started a month later, still going strong, from where the video of the Chafetz Chaim recently surfaced, a delegate from Israel the first day spoke and insulted Rav Kook, who by then was the Rav of the land of Israel. The Chafetz Chaim on the day stood up, shocked, and cried out, they denigrated the Rabbi of Eretz Yisrael. We should all tear Kriya. And he ran out. And he went back to his room. And he refused to join the convention again. He just waited for its conclusion so he could travel back to Poland with the other rabbis. When members of the delegation from Yerushalayim came to seek his bracha, he refused even to shake their hand, saying, I do not give shalom to those who stir machlokes against the Rav of Yerushalayim. You should know he's holy and pure, and whoever harms him will not be absolved. Reb Chaim Zimmern Zatzal once noted that the Chafetz Chaim's opposition to Zionism was rooted in one thing. The pasuk at the beginning of Tehillim, Kuf Chav Zayin, Shir Malchus Shlomo, Im Hashem Lo Yivneh Bayis, Shavam Lubonov Bo. If God doesn't build the house, the workers toil in vain. Im Hashem Lo Yishmor Ir, Shav Shakat Shomer. If God doesn't guard the city, then the watchman guards in vain. But he added, Reb Chaim did, that those who think the Chafetz Chaim would have said the same thing after the state was established, after the Holocaust, 40, 60, 70 years later, are denigrating that Gadol, because he was able to see events as well. And interestingly, his oldest son, Reb Aryeh Leib HaKohen Pupko, became the Rav of Radin, and in the late 1930s, he actually joined Mizrahi, late in his life. It's very reasonable to assert that the Chafetz Chaim was one of the most well-known, against his will, but also popular rabbis of his time. His humility was unsurpassed. In 1925, he wrote a letter in the Warsaw Jewish paper Der Yid, begging Jews who were writing to him to stop referring to him in their letters as a Gaon, as a Tzaddik, or any other title or accolade. He still saw himself as a simple Jew, a simple Eved Hashem. But this simple Jew, an Eved Hashem, lives with us every day. In every shul, yeshiva, any Jew opens up a Mishnah Berura, in the Chofetz Chaim Heritage Foundation, Shmiras HaLoshon campaigns that exist. In fact, there's a kibbutz Chofetz Chaim in Israel as well, named after him. He had four children with his first wife, Freda, who died in 1903. One son, Reb Avram, died tragically of pneumonia at age 23, just caught a cold in the bitter weather. He had two children with his second wife, Miriam Frieda, including Fega, who was born when the Chafetz Chaim was 64, and she married Reb Mendel Zaks, who was a reshiv in Radin, and then became a Rebbe at Rietz, and died in 1974. So you have from the Chafetz Chaim to his son-in-law a good span of almost 130 years. His oldest son, Reb Aryeh Leib, I mentioned a moment ago, died in 1938, just 5 years after his father's passing. And his brother's grandson, Reb David Leibovich, founded Yeshivas Chafetz Chaim in Queens, the father of Reb Heinrich Leibovich. Chafetz Chaim died 24th of Elul, September 15th, 1933. Do read the obituary in the Times. He wasn't 105. He was either 94 or 95 at the time. He's buried in Radin. His grave is on our itinerary for our trip this May. There are few rabbis who live on in our hearts and minds as much as Rav Yisrael Meir HaKohen Kagan, the Chafetz Chaim. Yehei Zichro Baruch. I thank you all very much.